Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I truly, I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V.
Today I welcome Brandy Scott. Brandy Scott is a radio presenter based in Dubai. Her 20-year journalism career has seen her work across radio, newspapers, and magazines in several countries. Not Bad People, the novel that we discuss today, is her first novel.
Hi, Brandy. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for joining me to chat about Not Bad People.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm a big fan, and this is kind of a bucket list thing for books in Australia, isn't it?
Wow, that's a big call, but thank you. Now, the novel, very enjoyable, must I say. I just tore through this novel, and, you know, it's not a small novel, and I just tore through it in about two nights because it's just this fun, enjoyable read, but really digs deep with the relationships. And it centres around the friendship of three women, Amy, Melinda, and Lou, and in many ways, it explores both the strength and fragility of these relationships. Why was this important for you to tell?
I was very interested in, I think, two different things. I'm quite interested in the dynamics of three-way friendships, which I've had a few times in different areas of my life, where there's three of you, and it doesn't mean the friendships can't be strong, but I find that there are often different dynamics between the pairs. And twos and twos and twos will often think different things about a third. And I was really interested in how that worked. I'm also really interested in how we treat the people who are our long-standing friends, which in many ways is how we treat the people who are our family, a lot more casually and sometimes with a lot less care than we treat our newer friends. You know, you can say what you like to family, and most of the time you know they're not going to go anywhere. And I feel that we can be a little bit rough on our long-standing friends as well.
It's so true, isn't it?
So the three women, they've known each other for a long time. They're very blunt with each other. They know where the vulnerable points are. And you know how you always, you know sometimes with long-term friends that there are places you just don't go in arguments because the hurt will be really, really deep.
Mm-hmm.
And these women do go there.
And the book is also about the corrosive power of secrets and their secrets. And, you know, I guess when I was thinking about this question, I was thinking about all the characters, and everyone has a secret. I think that's, you know, reflective of us as human beings as well. What was it about the idea of everyone having these really important secrets that appealed to you?
Do you know what? I just think by the time we reach our late 30s, and that's where the women are in this book, we're all carrying a bit of baggage. We've all done things we're not particularly proud of or we'd rather not talk about. We've all got history.
Absolutely. And all the characters are endearing because of their flaws and their secrets. And I think it works really well. Like, I love the title, Not Bad People, because you really see yourself within the pages. And like you said, we all make bad decisions and bad calls. Occasionally we are the bad guys, but hopefully there is redemption and forgiveness and the ability for us to move forward and change beyond that.
Do you know what? I'm so pleased you love the title. My mum, by the way, at the beginning really hated it. She kept emailing me and asking me to change it because she was worried that people would read it as not bad people. Comma in there. And that they would take it as a comment that the book was not bad.
I love that.
But I really liked the idea of normal people in tricky circumstances making bad decisions, because they're not bad people,
mm-hmm.
and they're just people under pressure. And we don't always, even with the best of intentions, we don't always make the right choices.
And sometimes you make bad choices when you look in retrospect, and sometimes you do bad things, but that doesn't make you a bad person. And that's why I really liked the title. I thought that really resonated.
And sometimes you make what at the time is your only choice or looks like a good choice.
Yeah.
But with hindsight, you know, you can't see around corners. You can only do what's in front of you at the time.
Absolutely. And you can almost justify anything to yourself, can't you? If you, from your perspective and your position, you can almost justify anything. And these women do some pretty powerful things to each other.
And they're banked into some corners. And yeah, that's absolutely what you can do with fiction, because a book called Quite Good People would be very dull. The point of writing fiction, and I was told, I did a creative writing master's in Wellington in New Zealand, and we were told that you have to put your characters under pressure. You can't, if you like a character, and I like all three of these characters for different reasons, I'm very fond of them, you can't go easy on them. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a temptation not to make bad things happen to them. But you have to, or else there's no book.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also have to make them do some bad things occasionally because it makes them interesting.
Exactly. And it's the decisions that people make, and it's the choices that people make, and it's the stuff they want and what they're willing to do to get it.
Mm.
Just the stuff of fiction.
Absolutely. What I quite liked about the book as well, you know, I said it was quite a fun read, but there was also a social commentary that underpinned it as well. And I thought that of the perception of the single woman in her 30s approaching 40 and how they're perceived. And even today, Melinda felt as if she was being perceived negatively. You know, she couldn't put herself in other people's shoes according to other people. And I thought it's a really tough world out there for single women in their 30s.
Well, this is where I tell you that I'm a single woman who's just turned 41. And I'm not saying it's autobiographical, because it's not.
Yeah.
But I did find it very cathartic to give voice to some of the frustrations that I've had over the last year or two, and some of my girlfriends as well, because you know what it's like. You have those sort of big chats into the night where you have a bit of a vent. And so Melinda really is made up of a number of my friends and myself in that regard. And some of the things, I mean, you know what it's like. You have a character and something that you felt maybe a 2 or 3 on the Richter scale, you make a 6 or a 7 for them. So you're amping it up. But it comes from a very real place, because if you don't have children, I do think that you are still, maybe judged isn't the right word, but people do make assumptions about you because of that choice.
There are different pressures that come with different lifestyles.
Oh, absolutely. And there are just general assumptions that are made about your attitude to work, the time you have available,
mm-hmm.
You know, that, oh, well, it's okay for you to do this on the weekend or in the evening because, you know, you don't have kids and other people do. And sometimes that's fine and fair enough, and sometimes it's not. The assumption that you have chosen not to have children, which isn't always the case. Sometimes it is, but it's not always the case. And I feel like, I mean, I've had a couple of people say to me over the years, and I have quite a busy job. I present a breakfast radio show, and it's an interview show where I live in Dubai. And I've had people assume that I've chosen a career over having children. And at no point in my life has someone come up to me with a clipboard and said, which one is it going to be?
Tick this box.
Would you like children? Do you know what I mean? You do what you can do with the time. And a lot of us who don't have children are putting the extra time into the career or the hobbies or writing books or whatever it happens to be, because what are you going to do? I mean, as Melinda says, you're not going to sit at home and wait for the husband and baby fairy to turn up.
Yeah.
Like, that never helped anybody.
And I loved Melinda's voice. I just thought it was so realistic and a voice that you don't often hear. And I thought, geez, we're in 2019. And it's true, these judgments or perceptions are still made of people. So I thought that was a really important part of the book.
I really enjoyed writing her. I mean, she's a lot bolshier than I am, and she says a lot of things that I wouldn't.
I think we all have a bit of Melinda in us. She really spoke to me. I really liked her.
Funnily enough, so many people have assumed that Melinda is me, which she both is, isn't she? But I mean, there's a lot of differences. She has a lot more confidence. She has an entrepreneurial spirit, which I most definitely do not. I'm far, far, far too risk averse to be Melinda. The character I probably actually have the most in common with is Amy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the one that most people think that I don't, which is quite funny.
Interesting. Well, I was going to ask about Amy because she experiences quite severe anxiety, and it appeared to me through this repetitive behaviour and the obsessive thoughts that anyone who's experienced anxiety can really relate to this. And I wanted to ask how you captured this anxiety, because it seemed to come from a very authentic place.
Because a lot of it is mine. And again, it's fiction. So you take, you know, you take an experience and you embellish it and you change it and you amp it up a little bit. So it's both mine and not mine, if that makes
sense. Yeah, absolutely. And as a person who has, I don't like to say suffered, but lived side by side with anxiety most of my life, I really got it. And I thought, yeah. And I loved the part where you said, you know, are you fortune telling? Are you catastrophizing? Are you distorting? Are you magical thinking? Are you doing other people's thinking for you?
Well, I may have filled in a form like that in my time. And do you know what? I'm with you. I don't really love the expression suffered from anxiety, because it's kind of a feeling of, I don't think it's helpful. But it was quite cathartic to write Amy, because I've given her a similar backstory to mine, where I also used to work in print journalism earlier in my career. And I left print journalism in different – I mean, I've made the examples and circumstances different for hers, because fiction has to be more interesting than real life. But – the actual sort of feelings and the terror and the worry about upsetting people and the worry about getting things wrong and the over-checking particularly comes from a very real place. I mean, it's why I went into radio, and it's why I left print media, because I just, yeah, it was just all-consuming. And it was I can't even come up with a good enough word. I felt like I was being stalked by anxiety. Yeah. While it's doing those jobs.
I got that from reading it, and I really liked when you broke it down, though, when I just mentioned the magical thinking and doing other people's thinking for you, because when you actually stop and you repeat those things to yourself, you can put anxiety back in its box, in a way.
But at the time, it feels real. I mean, this thing, and that's why the exercise that Amy does, where she literally puts her thoughts down on paper. I mean, I've done cognitive behavioural therapy before, I've done CBT, and I've done those sort of exercises. And the what's the worst that can happen exercise that Amy does, I've actually found more helpful than nearly anything else I've ever done. Because when you put it down on paper and you look at what the worst is that can happen in a scenario, most of the time it's something that you can deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also those statistics that 99% of the things you worry about, because you're always projecting into the future with anxiety, they don't happen. So that's a nice statistic to make yourself feel better.
I've always found that the stuff that has, you know, come out and bitten me has been stuff that I never would have dreamt up anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the novel also explores the complexity of the mother-daughter relationship with Lou and Tansy and her own mother, as well as history kind of repeating itself in some ways. And I thought the mother-daughter relationship is such a complex one to explore. So how did this come about for you?
I don't have kids, but I have been a difficult teenager, which is where Tansy comes from. My mother would tell you that I'm still a difficult teenager. But that mother-daughter dynamic is tough, but I love the relationship that Lou and Tansy actually have in the end. I mean, it's fraught. It's really fraught. And at the beginning, you know, they know how to push each other's buttons, but I think they also have a real closeness of having stuck it out, just the two of them, for so long.
And I think then Tansy also has a greater respect for her mother's journey and experiences once she begins to experience them herself.
She does. And I actually think they love each other a lot more than they realised even right in the beginning of the book. I mean, they are very much a team of two, and it's them against the world. I like the dynamic.
Yeah, me too. I really liked it too. You also explore the power of wealth, and although it may not make you happy, it does provide a freedom that people like Lou can't understand. And I thought it was very interesting that these women were so close and yet they lived quite different experiences, including, you know, one of very, you know, high wealth and then one who was struggling all the time and still trying to keep that friendship alive with those huge differences.
I don't know if it's because I'm a business journalist or not, but I am really interested in how what we've got shapes us. And it's not a particularly fashionable thing to say, but the writer Grace Paley said that, paraphrasing directly here, every story should have in it blood and money. And she was talking about family with the blood.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think those feelings of what you have, what I have, what I think you should be giving me, should you be sharing with me, even our family dynamics, money comes into it. If a sibling earns more than you, who's helping mum and dad, who should be, you know, are you helping us out? But hang on, you already own a house, so they can lend me money for a house, but not you. I mean, there is so much of that there. And even in the friendship dynamics, I mean, I've got friends who have more than me, and I've got friends that have less than me, and it's, I mean, we're not at each other's throats like these women end up. But I also know that there is that unspoken awareness of where you all kind of are on the financial ladder of life, whether we recognize it or not. I mean, I can remember a while ago now, but I've kind of never forgotten it. It's just a tiny little incident that it made me, when I was writing Lou and Melinda's dynamic, and Lou doesn't have much and Melinda's got quite a lot, it made me think of that I once bought a pair of shoes when I was studying, and so, you know, I was watching my cash a bit, and I liked them, they were a bit of a treat, and one of my friends who's exceptionally well off said, oh my god, I love those, so cheap and cheerful. I was just thinking, that's my, like, big treat for the, you know, the month. And so those tiny little careless comments I tried to capture with Lou and Melinda, because I think even if we don't acknowledge it, even if we don't realise it, that awareness of the dynamic, I think, is always there.
And it's interesting, being such close friends, that they did have at times that lack of awareness for other people's situations. And just like you said, with the cheap and cheerful shoes, Lou said, you know, they get me this present, you know, where am I going to take my, you know, beautiful handbag out? I'm getting this massage, which costs the same as my electricity bill. Like, they're not the things that I need. And I just thought that was interesting, because on the one hand, they think they're spoiling her. And she's like,
they think it's a treat because it's something she wouldn't do for herself. Mm. Exactly.
So it's interesting, that perception, isn't it? And even the closest of friends sometimes lack a bit of empathy for one another.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. But again, and it is the closest of friends, because new friends, we try and impress almost as though we're on a date. And ask a lot more about our older friends than we do with our newer friends, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I was speaking about this to someone, about how you treat your work colleagues, and saying you often treat your work colleagues better than you treat your spouse. You know, you're always very polite and very professional, and you come home and you're like, oh, I've had this terrible day. And I'm like, it just doesn't make sense in the grand scheme of things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sometimes the people who deserve it the most get the worst of us, and the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the setting of Hensley is quite important to the characters, and we talked a little bit about how environment shapes people. And in Hensley, you either love the small town like Amy, you want to escape like Lou, or you return like Melinda. And there's something about small towns, isn't it, that is a comfort for some people but is stifling for others.
Well, they make great fiction, for starters. I mean, there's a reason that a lot of books are written about small towns, and it's because they're pressure cookers. They push people together, and that makes things happen. I mean, I'm from a small town myself. It's a little more functional than Hensley is, it must be said. But I grew up in one, and I left it quite early. But, I mean, the best fun I had writing this book, I took a month off work and I drove around country Victoria, and just from small town to small town. And I made Hensley out of a mix of a lot of the towns that I went through. So Echuca was one, with the river, that section of the Murray without the paddle steamers is the river that I think of when I think of Hensley. And when I think of the buildings in Hensley, I think of Beechworth's Main Street, which is, if you've ever been, it's just gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. And then the ranges that I don't name in the book, because I didn't want anyone to think, oh, that's, you know, there. I think of as being the hills that are behind Heathcote. That kind of just rear up over the town. So I made my own up, but it's very much out of real parts.
I love that. And I love how small towns, they can be stifling, because everyone knows everything about everyone. It's terrifying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no real secrets in a small town, but there's also just so much that's not talked about as well, which, again, is just so fertile ground for fiction.
Now, you're a radio journalist based in Dubai often, hosting an award-winning news and interview show. How has it felt being on the other side?
I'm not loving being on the other side. Do you know what? I am exceptionally grateful for the fact that people want to talk about the book. That is wonderful. And I will talk about the book till the cows come home, because I had so much fun writing it. I just had so much fun writing it that I'm very happy to do that. But the element of control that comes with asking the questions, I prefer a little bit to answering them.
Because do you feel sometimes you just don't know what's coming next?
I'm a bit of an oversharer. And so I do worry that I'm going to, that I'm going to say too much. That's the big fear.
Oh, I don't think you've overshared enough yet. We'll have to keep talking. Now, this is your first novel. Tell us about the writing process for this novel and, you know, how did it impact you being your first finished novel?
Well, funny enough, I've written one more. I did a creative writing master's, as I mentioned, and for that I had to write a book. And I wrote a book that was looked at quite seriously by a publisher but didn't make it all the way to the end, which was amazing because it taught me how to write a book, and most importantly, I think it taught me that I can finish one. And the knowledge that you can make it to the other end and finish it is so valuable because we're talking sort of, you know, well, for me, I think it took about 10 months to write Not Bad People. I write a scene, and then the next day I wake up, and I edit and polish that scene, and then I write the next one. And then the next day I wake up, and I edit and polish the scene that I've just finished, and then I write the next one. And so you're going kind of back and forth and back and forth. If you ever did, like, cross-stitch and stuff as a kid, it reminds me, there was a stitch that went back, I think it was called backstitch, actually, that went backwards and over and backwards and over. And I always think of that, and it means that you're writing in a very linear fashion, which I do. There's absolutely no skipping ahead to write the, you know, the good scenes in the second half of the book. I write in order, and it means you're always really deep in the book and what's just happened, so you don't have to go back and fix it for flow. So when I got to the end of Not Bad People, I was at the end.
And I do see merit in going back and polishing a scene, because I think there's nothing worse than coming back to your work and being really unhappy with what you've written yesterday. And I feel like it may not inspire you to keep going, but if you have written and polished and, you know, you come back to it and you go, yeah, that's not too bad, it kind of then inspires you to keep going. Is that what you found?
It does. And the thought of getting to the end of, I mean, you mentioned it's not a small book. It's 136,000 words. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be 110. And the thought of getting to the end of that many words and thinking, right, now I have to go back and, you know, make it okay. I think I'd be too knackered, to be perfectly honest. I'd probably put it in a drawer and wouldn't touch it. So I like the fact that, I mean, don't get me wrong, when I gave it to HarperCollins, the publishers, there were bits where they said, okay, you know, can you go back and make this a bit more like that, and can you do... So there was still work to be done, but I knew that it was generally okay and that I didn't have this massive rewrite to do. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot more comfortable to deal with because, I mean, you're building a house, effectively. And so you want to get the foundations down and the walls up, and you want things to be in place and solid before you do the editing, which is really the interior decoration, if you like.
I like that. No, I do see the advantages to that process. Now, you said your first book didn't get published, but this one did. How did this publishing process work for you with HarperCollins?
Gosh, I feel like I won the lottery about 5 times in a row, which is what it is, because... I mean, if you were to sit down and think about the numbers, I just think you'd be too freaked out to continue. So I had written my first book, which was called The Repatriates, for my degree. And like as I said, a publisher was looking at it. And then when it became quite obvious that nothing was going to happen with it, I went and found myself an agent, the lovely Vicky Marsden, who's based in Auckland. And she said, okay, well, let me sort of shop it around a little bit. And it was set in New Zealand. And she said, you know, we'll look at some New Zealand publishers and we'll see if they're interested. And then she said, almost casually, is there anything else you're working on? Because they publishers like to see a pipeline. They like to see that you've got more than one idea and, you know, that there's more to come. And I said, well, I have got something. It's set in Australia and I've written sort of, I think, three chapters. And she was like, oh, we'll send it over. Let me have a look. And so I sent it over and she got back to me the next day and said, I can sell this. And within, I think, 3 weeks, HarperCollins had taken it to acquisitions and it wouldn't have been much over a month.
That's insane. Three chapters. I like how they have such foresight and I guess faith in you as well.
Which was fantastic because, I mean, it was so amazing to write a book and know that someone wanted it. You weren't just writing it hoping and thinking, right, when I get to the end of this, I then have to find an agent and then I have to, you know, they have to find a publisher. I wrote it knowing that they wanted it. I sent it to them halfway through and said, here we are at the halfway point. What do you think? And they were like, it's great. Keep going. And then I got to about the 90,000 word point and my editor, Catherine at HarperCollins, sent me a quick email saying, hey, just checking how you're going. Are you nearly finished? Because we were pretty much on deadline. And I rang Vicky, the wonderful agent, and said, no, I'm not nearly finished. I've got like 20,000 words to go. And she said, well, what do you realistically think you can do? And I said, you know what, I can take a week off work. So effectively 9 days with both weekends. And I'll just go and put myself away somewhere. So I went and booked myself into a hotel in the mountains in Dubai, which are not, I mean, rocky outcrops really, rather than snow-capped, because it's the desert. This little old hotel that I really like and love, and I know the GM, and I just wrote. And I had never had an experience like it. Up until that point, I had thought of myself as a 1,000-word-a-day author. And if I did 1,500 on the weekends, like, that was pretty good going. And I was sitting down and I was writing 5,000 words a day.
Wow.
And loving it. And then every night I would send them off to my two readers. One's in Singapore, one's in New Zealand, and my agent. And then I'd wake up because of the time difference and they'd be saying, love it, keep going. And then I'd do the same thing again. And I've never written at that speed. And that's the final, and I went way over, obviously. It was supposed to be 110. I just but that final, I wrote the final third effectively in about 9 or 10 days.
Wow. Isn't that insane?
Almost exactly as it is in the book. Very, very little of it is changed. And I couldn't figure out how it was so easy is the wrong word. And I realized it was because there is so much in the way of stakes and plot in the first two thirds that was kind of climbing the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And then that final third, you've just got to wrap it all up. And that's almost like skiing down the other side. And all the stuff was there and waiting. And you had to, it was like, right, well, I just need to resolve everything that's in play. And because it was already in play and it had been set up and that first two thirds was written, you know, much, much, much slower, it made that final third, it was just fun. I was going to bed every night just thinking, I'm loving this. Like, I am loving this. This is great.
That's amazing. I love that locked away for 9 days. That's fantastic. I think that's every writer's dream.
I'm not saying the work was great. I mean, as in, like, the process. As in, yeah. I was like, you know, this is so much fun. I'm enjoying this, and I thought it was going to be painful, and it's not painful. It's actually, yeah, it's just so much fun.
It was probably the timing is good as well because, you know, as you were saying, it was the last third. You weren't trying to still build character and build plot. It was all there, so you just had to bring it home. I love that. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, and I hadn't realised that it worked like that, that if you had enough in the way of, I mean, stakes are such cliched words in books, but if you just have enough that the characters have done and want and have messed up, quite frankly, then that's what you need to do. You're not trying to think up ideas in that last third. And that actually, I've realised, with the first book that didn't sell, it didn't have enough stakes in it. And I can see why. I mean, I can totally see why it didn't make it through to publication. It was you know, it's nicely written and all the rest of it, and I wrote it as part of an MA course, so it has been workshopped to death. But it just didn't have enough for us as readers to worry and wonder about.
Mm-hmm. And so what's next for you? Are you taking a break, or have you started on your third idea?
Oh, gosh. So I've started on the third idea. I did my first research interview yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my, I mean, I love, love, love this bit of it. I have a synopsis because I write the synopsis first. I like knowing where I'm going and what I'm trying to do with the story. So I have a title and I have a strap line. I worked in newspapers for a long time. So I have that, what I think of as a stand first. But there's still enough room for things to change as I'm writing, mm-hmm. which is really important.
Yeah.
Also, otherwise it would be boring. Like if I knew everything that was going to happen, it would be boring to write.
Yeah, you need to surprise yourself at some point.
Well, it has to be fun for me too, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So I'm doing all the research at the moment, and I really, with Not Bad People, I did all the research at the start. Like I went around wineries, I spoke to people involved in both the growing and the making of wine. I spoke to pilots, I went flying with pilots. And I did all that really early because the research actually is really great for informing the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to people and saying, right, this is the scenario that I'm setting up. What could go wrong?
I love that. And you know what? Your research for Not Bad People just sounded a bit too much fun. Wineries and pilots and flying.
Oh, you're going to write a book. I mean, you have to set it somewhere with, like, great food and great wine. That's now a given.
To my mind, now is boggling about what kind of research you're up to now. I mean, how do you top wineries and pilots and flying planes? I'm really looking forward to the next installment.
And it will have one of the characters, one of the minor characters. It's not a sequel. There's not a sequel to Not Bad People. I would feel like I was, deliberately extrapolating.
Yeah.
But it does take one of the minor characters, which is Stacey, who's the reporter.
Oh, wow.
And she is the main character in the next book, and I just love that there's that thread between the two.
Yeah, I really like that too, because I often find when I read a book, it's sometimes those minor characters that I want to know more about because there's something interesting about them or different about them. So I love that idea of taking a character out and hearing her story. That's wonderful.
And it's more about family than friendships.
Not Bad People was so much fun, but it had a lot of heart, and I loved the social commentary that underpinned it, and it was just such an enjoyable read. And, you know, I know it was an enjoyable read because I just kept flying through it, and every time I had a spare minute, I'd be like, oh, I just have to get another chapter in because I wanted to see what was happening, what was going on. And I loved reading about the tangled web of these relationships between the characters because it was so reflective of our lives as women of this age. So thank you so much for writing it, and thank you for spending time with me today on the podcast.
Thank you for enjoying the book and for wanting to talk about it.